let's get started.
Okay, we've got three of us who have contributed to FSRN and are happy to share, you know, what knowledge we have. We don't pretend to have it all, at least I speak for myself. I think we should introduce ourselves. My name is Martha Baskin. I'm actually one of the founders of FSRN, and I'm happy to go into that spin if you want it later.
Yeah, I'm Lee Robartis. I was also pretty much on the founding steering committee. I guess I arrived a couple months late. But I've been with FSRN since 2000 and producing stories on a freelance basis all that time, and spent a couple years on the steering committee. And I operate out of Moscow, Idaho, where I live, and running a low-power FM community station there called Radio Free Moscow.
And I'm Julie Sabatier, and I'm actually relatively new to FSRN. I just started doing stories late last year, and I've done maybe a dozen or 14 stories for FSRN since then, so, yeah.
Well, I mean, before we get started, are people curious about FSRN's inception from the get-go? Born in 99, at least in the minds of a lot of us who were giving stories to Pacifica back then, and born out of frustration because Pacifica's board was corporate controlled, and the board was thinking of selling off the flagship stations in Austin and New York City and Los Angeles and San Francisco. And so all of us who contributed to Pacifica said, okay, we've got to do something about this. We're not going to continue to sell our stories to this entity that is trying to go commercial. So FSRN was born in late 99 and then started airing, was it March of 2000?
January.
Thank you.
Yes.
Exactly. And then fortunately, simultaneously, at least here in the local market, KBCS was just coming out finally and being a public affairs entity and not just pure music. And so it was a marriage made in heaven at that point in time. I think then just to get rolling here, you know, when the request for a workshop was on FSRN stories. I'm going too fast. Let's at least introduce ourselves.
Kurt,
let's say who we are, and let's add two things, who you are and what your reporting experience is, so we get kind of a sense.
My name's Kurt Firestone, and my reporting experience is close to zero. And in fact, I've spent most of my time being on the other side, being asked to comment on things because I was a candidate for office.
I'm Larry. Straight out of college, I went into print, Gannett, the Olympian Gannett. And I was on KAOS as a volunteer DJ for years, and then I moved up here. Did a lot of stories for the Seattle IMC and the other IMCs around the country, and last year and a half, I've been reporting and editing for KBCS.
KEOS, is that in Southern? Did you say KEOS was the original?
KOS,
sorry.
I'm Larry. I'm with the National Lawyers Guild Center for Democratic Communications. Let's see. How did I get involved in this part of it?
You were defending me.
I've been an indie media journalist, so that's true. And a lot of grassroots stations, licensed and unlicensed. Also was living in Berkeley and represented folks who were arrested when the police and private security were called in to drag people out of KPFA during the height of the corporate takeover.
Yours might be better.
And then did a mediation with FSRN and Pacifica a couple years ago now.
There's chair available to me. Let's ideally stick it to our name and our writing experience. But of course, Larry, we had to know what he's done for it. Introductions and your what? How much reporting radio reporting experience you have?
Not at all. I'm not a reporter. Okay. I just want to get involved in this process.
What's your name?
Navi.
Navi, welcome.
I'm Brendan, involved with Free Radio Olympia and COA in Olympia. And writing, reporting experience, a few years in upstate New York with indie media and independent newspapers in Syracuse, Utica.
I'm
Erin
Akia from
KVU
in Portland, and I'm
And I've had a lot of writing and radio experience, but mostly with public affairs stuff, so like 1 hour format.
And my name is Julia Donovan. I've been in public affairs with KBCS for 2 or 3 years, something like that, so I've done more feature stories.
My name is Tom Kaloran. I left radio 15 years ago, but I'm now serving on the board of KCR. Very interested in content.
I'm Vinny Lombardo. I actually am an FSRN stringer as well. Currently an elected steering committee member, and have been freelancing with FSRN for about 2.5 years. But I have about 11 years of radio experience, mostly pirate radio.
My name is Ryan. My name is Ryan. I'm with Free Radio Olympia, and as well, I used to work with KGHP in Deep Harbor. And let's see, I've done a number of produced shows which are available online, and also I've written for Indie Media and a couple of other local outlets.
My name is Havens. I'm a volunteer with KBCS and no recording experience.
Joan Calhoun. I've done a little bit of interviewing and reporting for KBCS, but very little.
I'm Bill Ratcliffe, and I have no recording.
Carl Middlestad, I have 9 years shoving a mic in a small town of 2,000 people's face.
Chris Feinersek, I had a couple of years of public affairs production at KBCS.
Tom Allen, 5 years at KBCS public affairs and 3 years at KREB, and 25 years as a technical writer.
And how many of you would actually like to start filing reports for FSRN, just a show of hands? And so, and the rest of you are, might?
Might. Maybe we should ask that question again at the
end. Okay. Now that you know everything. I mean, it's, you know, to choose a story, well, obviously you're choosing something that you know, that you have experience in, that you're familiar with. I think many of us in this type of world of reporting have also been activists and or continue to be activists in various arenas. And the two are allowed to live in harmony. How I do it is, if I'm an activist on, you know, reproductive rights, I don't do stories in that area. Instead, I'll do stories in the environmental area. But what's so grounding and powerful about the kind of news reporting that I think most people do at this conference is that ideally you're giving voice to the voiceless. And you're turning a story around. You're turning it sometimes literally 360 degrees on its head from where even an NPR reporter might take the story or choose to lead with it. And that's a really, really important thing to recognize and to not be afraid of, and to say, yeah, if I'm in a courtroom, I'll always remember this. Right after 9/11, of course, around the country, there were people being rounded up like mad. And here in Seattle, there was a man named James Ujamaa, an African-American Muslim, who was rounded up by the FBI, and he ended up serving about 18 months before the FBI finally said, nope, we don't really have any evidence on you, and so you're out. But in the courtroom, there were agents with the FBI. There were reporters from all over the country, because it was still new. And in the courtroom, agents with the FBI were admitting the vagueness of the word conspiracy and the fact that they really had virtually no evidence on this man. His crime was that he'd been in Afghanistan at the wrong time and that he had attended a London mosque at the wrong time for a period of time. And I remember when I did the story, and then I heard my colleague, Wendy Kaufman, who was next to me right in the courtroom, when I heard her story and I heard mine, I said, damn, that just really says it all, because she didn't even mention what I was hearing in the courtroom, and that really, really rang home for me. Choosing a story, if you listen to FSRN stories these days, you know that a lot of the coverage is international. A lot of it's international. And I think I can be somewhat critical since I'm a part of it. There's really room for domestic coverage. There's a need for domestic coverage. Of course, then you have to be able to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, West Coast time, and pitch, you know, convince the editorial board, because it's essentially five people who are all speaking together from East Coast and the West Coast, deciding what stories to run. And there's always going to be stories out of Lebanon and Iraq and D.C. galore. But if you've got a story out of, you know, Oklahoma or Seattle that has a national angle, you're going to have to know how to pitch it. And I think that that'll come in later. But I mean, for example, yesterday's story, the features, there were four out of D.C., Bush defends detainee policy, Aaron Glantz was in D.C., U.S. gives up on Anbar province, U.S. Marine Corps story, but out of D.C., Anastasia, I think that's regular. Iraqi politicians on Capitol Hill, out of D.C., House of Rep votes for fences on U.S.-Mexico border, out of D.C., okay, then one in Israel, one Naomi Fowler out of London, and then Argentina, to recall all the high school students who were taken. August 2006 features, one out of the Congo, one out of Lebanon, again Lebanon, Bush reclassifies nuclear docs, D.C., anti-war camp, then there was me. Anti-war candidate. Anti-war candidate challenges Washington State Democrats. I think we should be aware then, just with that rundown, is that this isn't easy getting in domestic coverage on the national scene, because FSIRN has only got those 28 minutes, and their primary. Well, we can talk about that. I mean, those of us who've been a part of it have been having this dialogue for many, many years of where is the balance between domestic and national coverage. Who to interview? I mean, this is fairly basic and transparent. You know, if you're doing a story on a candidate that the Democratic Party is ignoring, well, clearly you start with the Democratic Party. Well, you start with that candidate. In this case, Hong Tran is being shortchanged by the Democratic Party, who's already chosen our state senator. You're going to give voice there. You're going to give voice. Then you obviously have to let the Democratic Party speak, hear their point of view. You perhaps want to hear a point of view of someone who is voting, knows they're going to vote for Tran. You're not denying voices by any means. It's just depends on who you're going to lead with. That's so really different in this kind of grassroots reporting.
Do we want to go on about choosing a story?
Yeah.
Okay.
Want me
to talk about writing and then you can talk about production?
I just have a couple of things to say on choosing a story, and then maybe we should go to gathering audio and then the isolating sound bites and writing. Okay. And the thing I just want to say, coming out of a rural, isolated area where a big city is 90 miles away, that this type of stories I do, living in Idaho and so forth, tend to be, well, I do a lot of environmental. For a long time, I've done a lot of human rights story because there's racist activity in our area of northern Idaho. And it's sort of died down, but, you know, those things do pop up. And then I look for national issues with maybe a local spokesperson. So you can cover, even though I live in Idaho, I can cover stories that deal with the entire nation. But we have access to two major universities in our remote area, corner of the world, and there may be university professors or experts on that issue if you look for them. I've done stories on things like internet issues and sort of esoteric things like the digital radio proposals and how that might cause interference with small stations. I just did one this week on a ballot initiative that's on, in one form or another, on the ballot in six western states involving takings. Their bill is eminent domain ballot measures, but actually they go a lot further and they sort of make it impossible for local groups to do zoning laws. Well, Idaho is one of those states with those. I interviewed people from Washington and Idaho on that and talked a little bit about the funding coming from this billionaire in New York City that's channeling money through Montana into the California initiative on takings. So I guess the point is you can cover national stories even if you're in an isolated rural area by finding people who can talk on that issue. And I think sometimes the timing of your pitch to FSRN is important. For example, you know, Ralph Nader happened to be visiting Spokane a couple weeks after 9/11. The people at the college he was speaking said, well, in the press conference, he's not going to talk about 9/11. And, of course, the first question I asked was, you know, his reaction to that, because it was just an obvious thing. But basically, you know, sometimes you have national figures coming through your area. The reason you want to interview people face-to-face with a microphone is FSRN sort of frowns upon, in the feature part of the newscast, that's the longer stories in the last 25 minutes of the newscast, they frown upon using all your audio interview tape being from the telephone. I have gotten a few stories on that way, but they do like you to interview in person, and definitely bonus points, if not extra money, not extra money, but bonus points for ambient sound at, you know, sound at a demonstration, sound of, you know, logging trucks or trees being cut down or whatever. That definitely helps draw in the interest of a listener. In case you don't know, Free Speech Radio News, each newscast is divided into two parts. There's the headline section, which is the first 6 minutes of the show, and those stories are limited to 1 minute. The pay is really low. It's $20 for a voicer with just your voice and $30 for a voicer with interview segments. And once again, those are limited to usually 45 seconds to a minute.
I think it's 60 now.
60, generally, yeah. 60, but sometimes if it's just a voicer, they want it even shorter.
I mean the pay.
Oh, it's gone up?
It is.
Well, that's what it says on these pitching guidelines, which I got from the website.
Okay, very good.
But it says, I mean, for voicer, it says voicer is...
Okay.
No, headline, voicer is 20. Sorry, voicer is 20. Let's go over it. Voicer is 20, 30 for a headline with soundbite, and...
160.
Right, but
Julie. This is false.
This is false information. No, because, well... But see, now they have a thing.
For a feature,
right.
30 for a headline.
But they have a thing now called a mini feature that's like under 2 minutes. I'm sorry, I got it confused with the headlines. But they have a thing now that's called a mini feature that they pay $60 for. So it's between the 30 and the 80.
Right. So if you do a full-blown feature in the bottom 25 minutes of the story, you will get $160 for doing it, which isn't really that much. Depending, sometimes you can whip something out in a day. It'll depend on the story. Sometimes you have to travel, and a lot of times I choose story. I'm the news director of a low-power FM station. I'm involved in writing news every day and doing interviews every day and going out in the field. And so I'll sometimes collect audio, think about pitching a story maybe a few weeks or a month later, for a feature on FSRN, and have that audio ready for that story. Some stories aren't super timely, especially when you're working out of an area like Idaho. You can just anticipate that, okay, this ballot measure is coming up or this issue is ongoing, and they don't necessarily need a story on a particular day. They can even approve your story, have you upload the audio to Free Speech Radio News, and they may sit on it for a couple weeks till there's a less busy news day, and then you can you know, get paid for that story. So you can think about collecting audio over a certain amount of time. You don't have to spend the entirety of 3 days you know, working on this story if you have other jobs and, you know, other things you have to get done in life. So that's all I have on choosing a story. And I guess we... You have some things on choosing
I have stuff on pitching.
Okay.
Can talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Okay. One of these handouts is called Pitch and Email Exchange, and it's from a story that I pitched about 6 months ago in May, and at the top of the page you'll see the pitch, and then there's sort of an exchange for that I had with the producer between when like when I pitched the story. So this is an example of a story I worked on for a couple of days. This was when the FBI approached a city employee outside of Portland City Hall and said, would you like to pass along information to us about Portland City Hall? And she said, no, thank you, and I'm going to tell my boss about this. And so the mayor decided to go public with it about a week later. And I was listening to, I was actually listening to NPR, and I heard the story. Like, they did a little, you know, this news is breaking now, kind of thing in the at the top of the hour. And I pitched it right away. I sent off this email, and I said, I thought you might be interested in this story that's breaking in Portland right now. I'd like to interview the mayor. I'd like to interview the FBI. Obviously, I can't do that, you know, in a day. But I could have a story for you. I said, let me make some calls, and I'll tell you how fast I could have the story for you. So we kind of went back and forth about when could you have the story. And then finally, when I did a script, which I also have as a handout, we went back and forth about edits. They said, please cut the last actuality and stuff like that. So this was also, well, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about choosing audio first, but this was an example of just getting on the story right away. And so I pitched the story. They got back to me pretty soon after that, the next day, and said, we'd like to have the story. And I called the FBI. First I called Mayor Potter's office, because he went public with it in the first place, so I thought, he's going to want to talk to the press. I couldn't get a hold of him. I couldn't get a hold of anybody who could tell me when he could meet with me. So I called the FBI, and I said, can I talk to the special agent in charge? And they were really accommodating. They were like, yeah, we really want to talk to the media about this. And so that sort of gave me some leverage. I made an appointment to talk to the FBI, and then I called back Mayor Potter's office and said, you know, the FBI's going to talk to me, so do you want to talk to me too? And then I thought, well, who else will have kind of an interesting perspective on this story? And I called David Fedenke, who's our executive director of the Oregon ACLU, and just to sort of give a historical perspective of, like, you know, is this normal for the FBI to be wanting to, you know, to investigate City Hall when there's no kind of evidence of public corruption or anything like that? And what does it say about, like, a national trend in terms of surveillance and spying on government, spying on city government, and things like that? So then those ended up sort of coming together all in a couple of days, and then I produced the story. So you want to talk about audio, and we can go back to this?
Yeah. How come not the person that was approached?
She would remain anonymous, and the city said...
So you had no way of even knowing?
No. She chose to remain anonymous. All I knew was that she was an employee of the city attorney's office, and I called the city attorney's office, and they said, no way, we're going to talk to you.
But what I think is important, though, to recognize is that you're having to educate, you know, editors in California and D.C. about why you think your pitch is important.
Sure.
So, Julie, this is perfect. It's very concise. It's positive. Very, very short and to the point. I mean, for writing in and of itself, I'm actually comparing it to the wrangles I go through. Sometimes, you know, I get too much. So this is good. Make it concise and clear, because it's a sell. This collective business sounds good, but no. From my perspective, for the last 6 years, you're having to sell your idea, and so you better have it down and know how to promote it well.
So this is a good example of a pitch from a local story that has national significance. And, you know, I pointed out the national significance in there. I pointed out that the city of Portland has a sort of a contentious relationship with the FBI because of past incidents, and kind of went into that a little bit to kind of give some kind of perspective and context for why is this a really important story.
How long did you finish the piece?
My finished piece was 3 minutes and 20 seconds, I think, it says.
And they liked you to, they seem to ask you to target to 3.5 minutes. 4 minutes is what they say is their limit. And that's what I'll tell you is their limit. I've managed to get some longer pieces on just purely because it took a little longer to tell the story, and they were willing to make an exception. But you shouldn't count on that. You should really try and get it below 4 minutes. And the tendency is to write long, and we'll get to that a little bit. I think we want to go to the nuts and bolts of just a little bit about the nuts and bolts of doing interviews and recording, and I'll make this really quick. I'm recording this session on my mini disc recorder, which is a fairly cheap but good sounding device. There are professional style mini disc recorders that are more expensive in the $500 range. Nowadays, more and more recorders are using what are called flash recorders, which just have a essentially a computer memory chip in them, and they enable you to if you say recorded a 2 hour program or something just to get one soundbite, you can actually go into the port in your computer with the audio from the flash recorder, and you've got the 2 hours right on whatever your editing program is, and you can say, well, in your notes it was 1 minute and 15 seconds, one hour and 15 minutes into the recording there was a good soundbite. You can go on your long sound file, find the 1 minute and 15 second point, and listen around and find the soundbite that you want. So I just use a mini disc recorder because it's cheaper, and I have my station and I haven't gotten enough money together to buy a really good flash recorder. We have a cheap one, but I'm not happy with the sound quality of that. It records MP3.
We just bought these flash recorders for KVU, and this is my personal equipment, but I'm pretty happy with it, except that the battery is irreplaceable. You have to keep recharging the battery in order to get it to...
Right, so you have to remember to plug it in at night.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. A lot of the audio you will get will be through interviews in person. Sometimes I will use a mic stand and put it in front of somebody, but because I'm also recording for my local news department and sometimes don't have time to edit interviews with scripts, I like to hold the mic so my questions get on tape too, and then go back to that. And there's been other workshops and interviewing techniques. But a lot of your audio will come over the telephone. If you have a good telephone interface system in your station, that's great. We record directly into one of our computers at the station, so there's a sound file instantly available as soon as you're done doing the interview. And we record the phone interviews actually in stereo, with one channel being the audio you're getting from the person you're interviewing and one channel being your voice. That allows you to isolate sound, and you can push the mute button on the channel in your mixer, and so that when you're recording somebody else's voice, you're only recording the sound coming through the telephone, and none of the ambient noise in the room or your breathing gets onto the recording. There's also a cheap $20 interface if you're really poor, like Radio Shack, that you just plug in between the wall. And it doesn't work that great, but if you try not to breathe, I've done a lot of interviews that way, and it sounded okay. But I like the new system a lot better. One thing you should know is that not every time you go to record something you'll be able to set up a mic. Sometimes there's formal occasions or something where they don't want you putting your mics there, maybe a candidate's debate. Then you might have to go to the back of the room where the sound guy is and plug into their mixing board. And I try and carry quite a few different little connectors, like an RCA connector. But no, this is a quarter inch. I have some RCA connectors, an XLR connector, like goes into the back of the mic, except sometimes goes into the back of mixing boards. And my mini disc recorder has a mic input, and it also on the side has a line input. And is everybody familiar with the two types of audio that you can record electronically? Mic level is basically, as the name implies, the level you get from a mic, which is really tiny electrical impulses. Line level is more amplified, and if you plug into the backs of a mixing board and then go into your mic level, it's going to override and be distorted. So I have the other input, and when you buy a recorder, it's good to look for extra inputs. I mean, if one breaks, if nothing else, but just to have a little variety there, and the line level just records fine. Another thing you can do, if you don't quite get the right levels or if they're a little too hot for your mic level and then you only have a mic level, this is a $2, $3 device from Radio Shack. It's designed for people who have Walkmans but don't want to reach all the way down and adjust the volume, so you can adjust the volume here. And there's an expensive version you can get for about $60. If you have that money, it's more for professional radio, and it's big and hunky. And if you want, if you have the money, I'd recommend buying those. And if you do buy one of these, buy two in case one breaks. But this will reduce the sound level, so if you're going into your mic input from a room PA source or something and it's too hot, well, bring your headphones with you and listen as you're testing the recording, and if it sounds distorted, turn up the volume well in your headphones, then you can turn this little thing down and get a lower level input. It's not the greatest
one.
I don't know what it's called. They have them at Radio Shack. So, yeah?
Is the benefit of using that rather than the mic level on your unit so that you don't have to touch your recorder?
Well, my unit doesn't really, it sort of automatically sets the record level, and that's one of the things. And some of the more professional models, you'll just be able to adjust things, but still, sometimes the sound will be too hot.
Right.
But if you have a professional recorder, you probably have a mic and a line input, so it's not a big deal. This is a cheap solution for people who are doing it on the cheap. And I think that's all I have to say. It's usually better to mic somebody like at a press conference than to use the PA if you can get away with it. It's just that certain formal occasions, like some speeches in academia or whatever, they don't want you sitting up here with a microphone next to their nice microphone. So
there's also the belt and suspenders, which we had to use at the SEC hearings a couple of years ago because the PA board went down. And I had a mic on a stand, and that's all we had when we were done it. Mark and I kind of went back and forth passionately on the other.
It's a good idea to invest in a floor mic stand, too. Not just one of those, but one that sits on the floor and bring it with you. It's amazing. I go to certain press events or public meetings, and you get the commercial radio station asking if they can duct tape on top of your microphone. So they won't have to hold their mic in the air and have the blood draining out of their hands the whole time. If you put a mic down on a podium or lectern to record somebody, the sound will bounce off that and it'll sound really crummy. So you really need to float your microphone in air in some way. You can, it's also good to buy a good microphone or have a good microphone that doesn't pick up a lot of hand noise. Some of the cheaper microphones, they might have just as good sound and frequency response as the cheaper and the more expensive ones might have the same frequency response, but you'll notice if as you handle them, the slightest movement of your fingers comes out. Whereas this is a Shure, 54A, whatever. It's really good for handheld interviews because for some reason the shank of the microphone is isolated enough. So that's it on recording audio. I mean, I think it's good to. Yeah, I'll get to go out in the field, even if it involves a bit of a drive. And sometimes for the really long drives, FSRN will supply travel money. But, when I go 90 miles up to Spokane, I usually don't ask for it, at least at the previous gas prices.
Do you want to talk about choosing
audio? We have a question.
Just briefly while we're on mics, can you just touch briefly on what do you use when you want to use a...
I don't have a switch. This is a sort of directional thing. I guess I won't touch on that too much. I mean, okay. Basically, how much sound? If you're in a protest situation, there's a lot of sound all around. You probably want to get sound from all around. Directional mic isolates things better.
I don't know. I have a cardioid mic that I use for it for like everything, which means that the pattern is heart shaped, and so it's like a nine. I mean, it's a smaller degrees pattern, but it's I find that that's really good for like protests and stuff. If you want to interview people, if you want to get ambient sound, use
right.
the stereo mic. But if you want to just like interview somebody in the middle of a protest, like why'd you come here today?
Right.
You want that noise, but you don't want it to overwhelm your interviewee. So the mics that are, unidirectional will have you'll still get that outside noise, but the most sound that you'll get will be from that person who's speaking right into your microphone.
Yeah, there's a website called transsom.org, transsom.org, and they go into tools in a lot of great details.
They're a great resource for radio in general.
Okay.
Do we feel then that the trio that we've given enough of the basics at this point to start opening?
Well, I
up?
Had a couple of audio clips that I wanted to play.
Oh,
if
okay.
people are interested,
well,
I don't know.
Let's
look
at the time. Where
helpful.
Are we at the time?
It's
2:17, and we go till when? 2:30?
Three.
Okay. Oh, all the way to 3?
Yeah. But we do want
to
open up.
Actually, guys, go to 2:45, sorry. Because people have to get from one place to another.
Okay, so we'll open it up for discussion after we...
I don't know. Are people interested in hearing audio?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Well, here... Okay. This story... I'm going to play some clips from the FBI interview that I was sad that I didn't get to include in my piece because they're a great example of how you don't really have to editorialize with people like the FBI because they sound pretty dumb anyway. they do. They're totally patronizing. So here's a great example of that. This is Dan Nielsen, special agent in charge of the FBI in Portland. And here's me talking to him a little bit.
So Mayor Potter's assertion that the FBI was trying to have an informant inside City Hall, was that correct?
We were trying to talk to somebody. There's no question about that. Whether you characterize them as an informant, somebody who talks to us, as a reporter, do you have what you would characterize as spies inside City Hall? Or do you talk to people in City Hall? We all talk to people. Characterizing as spies would be like saying that the Portland police are spies when they're out on routine patrolling in the neighborhoods here.
You see what I mean there? This was another great clip that I have to play for you. It's talking about public perception of law enforcement. That's not my computer.
Should I show it?
You can show the audio if you want to.
Yeah, just give people an idea of the editing.
Sure. This is a crappy editing program that I use that doesn't work in multitrack, but...
That's not the same.
Is he over here? No. Let me just play it.
Yeah, never mind.
Sound. Okay, here you go.
One of the things that's difficult with... I'm going to say in the FBI, but it's really in law enforcement in general, is sometimes people have the perception of it's the FBI. It's Dan. It's me. I'm your neighbor. My kids play soccer with your kids. Cross paths down at grocery store and other places.
Creepy. I did not use that, but I wanted to, but there was really no place to put it in the story. So let me play the. I know. I want to mix it somehow. But let me just play the story for you, and I think you'll see why there was no place to fit that stuff in. Sorry.
Submit that to KBCS. We will play that.
And then the FBI will come after me. All right, here you go. So this is the story as it turned out.
Portland Mayor Tom Potter has made public an attempt by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to make contact with a source inside the local city hall. The FBI acknowledged that one of their agents had approached a city employee, but said the agency is not currently investigating Portland city government. FSRN's Julie Sabatier has the story.
On May 11th, an employee of the city attorney's office for Portland, Oregon, was approached by Agent Jeffrey Pritchett of the FBI. Agent Pritchett, who was loosely acquainted with the city employee, asked if she knew any city council members. He mentioned that white-collar crime and public corruption are top priorities for the FBI and asked if she would be willing to pass on information about people who work for the city of Portland.
I was shocked.
That's Portland Mayor and former Chief of Police Tom Potter. He became aware of the incident after the unnamed city employee reported it to her boss. When he met with Special Agent Dan Nielsen of the FBI, he learned that the Bureau does not currently have an investigation open at City Hall.
There should be some mutual respect and understanding of what each other's roles are. And for me, that's not the job of the FBI, to spy on local governments when they have no knowledge of any wrongdoing.
Agent Nielsen, who serves as Assistant Special Agent in charge of the Portland Division of the FBI, says Mayor Potter overreacted to the conversation that took place between his agent and the city employee.
I tried to talk to the mayor. It didn't seem like you really wanted to hear much beyond you as the FBI spying on me. That was simply not the case. It wasn't the context, it wasn't the nature, it wasn't the intent.
Portland city government has had a rocky relationship with the FBI during Mayor Potter's term in office. Last spring, with overwhelming public support, the city council voted to pull Portland police officers off the FBI-led Joint Terrorism Task Force. And Portlanders haven't forgotten that one of their own citizens, lawyer Brandon Mayfield, was wrongfully arrested in connection with the 2004 Madrid train bombings. Again, Mayor Potter.
public corruption exists in the United States. There's just no doubt about that. And that there has to be someone who investigates that. And that's probably a good role for the FBI. But when you have no knowledge and that you are not conducting any investigation into any wrongdoing on the part of the city, what is the role of the FBI then?
This comes at a time when the role of federal investigators is very much at the forefront of the national discussion. An FBI raid on Congressman William Jefferson's office was heavily criticized Tuesday during hearings before the House Judiciary Committee. And Americans are still reeling from the revelation that all of our phone records are available to the National Security Agency. Oregon ACLU Executive Director David Pedenke says the incident in Portland is part of a national trend towards more aggressive FBI tactics when it comes to investigating political groups and government employees without any evidence of criminal activity.
The Attorney General's guidelines, which were originally put in place during President Ford's administration in the mid-70s, those guidelines originally were designed to prevent this kind of fishing expedition by the FBI. Unfortunately, former Attorney General Ashcroft greatly weakened those guidelines and opened the door for these kinds of abuses on a broad scale.
At Mayor Potter's request, the FBI will conduct an internal investigation to determine whether or not Agent Pritchett acted appropriately. Agent Nielsen says he welcomes the evaluation, but he maintains that there has been no violation of policy here. For FSRN, this is Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
Six of 13 people arrested last year in a nationwide FBI stop.
Okay. Sorry.
Julie, did mainstream media pick that story up?
Yes. They did. But, yes. This was a story that I actually I did for FSRN, and then I actually sold it to a print media source called the New Standard, which is online. And they're another. They were they're another non-commercial, non-profit organization. Actually, they're facing serious serious issues, but they're a great news organization. So this was a story that a lot of people were interested in.
And they also have a 5-minute radio show.
They do.
Yeah.
They do.
Did you break it?
I did not. I mean, the local media broke it as soon as the mayor. I mean, the mayor called a press conference and,
wow,
you know, had,
once you found,
yeah. But, yeah, this was what, this was sort of,
A lot of times FSRN gets a different angle on the story or gets perspectives that don't really, get in what's called the mainstream media. I call it corporate media. And living in Idaho, I do interview a lot of conservative people for my stories. I think it is important for the activists and progressive communities to hear what the side that counter to them is saying. It helps bring the dialogue on an issue around. So, FSRN, you can say it's a progressive news organization, but you know the listeners do need to hear a certain amount of what, whether it's Republicans or sometimes racists in the case of Northern Idaho, are saying, so that the arguments can be countered, and it adds depth to the story to hear them. I usually put them at the beginning and then have activist groups respond to them. It's not always the sequence of things, but...
Well, that's how I did this story. I mean, right. If you have a script in front of you, there's not enough copies for everybody, but if you can share. This is sort of a good example of how a script comes together. It's like, you're expected to write the anchor intro, you're expected to transcribe your actuality, which doesn't mean that you have to transcribe your entire interview, but if that helps you, it's helpful to me sometimes to just transcribe everything and then pick and choose once it's on the page. There really wasn't room in this story to sort of have those clips of the FBI being pedantic and patronizing towards me as a reporter, because there was so much information to cram in there. So basically, there was enough time to have one cut of the FBI saying, well, that's not what we were doing, and everyone else saying, actually, it was. So I think it's helpful to have just sort of the most straightforward quotes you can have, people conveying information that you're not conveying in your narration. So what's, like, their new information or perspective or opinion that people aren't going to get from just a straight story. So
So why don't we see we've covered lots of issues here, choosing a story, the editing side, working with FSRN, how to make a pitch. What categories do people have questions of, and let's see if we can make this run here a little bit with the limited time we have left. Are there how many people have actual technical editing? Doing the digital edit. Okay. One, two, three.
Oh, have the ability to.
Yeah, what are you asking?
Yeah.
I'm asking rather than have, you know, all 30 of us pose an individual question, how many people are curious about digital editing?
Yeah.
Well, maybe we should just open it up for general questions.
Oh, yeah, let's see what happens.
I have a question.
Yeah. Go for it.
With your story, when you interviewed the mayor, or did you interview the mayor, or was that from the press conference?
No, I did interview the mayor.
Okay. That's one thing. I don't know because I came in late, but I didn't hear you talk about press conferences and how, you know, that can get your actuality, you know, into the story. So do you want to comment on that about...
I'd say interviews in person are preferable, but a press conference is a good chance to get some audio if you need it, and sometimes it's your only chance to ask certain questions. And I also went into that it's, for a press conference, it's better to set up your mic than to use the sound system in the room.
Too, you have to be, like, in the know about when the press conference is going to happen.
That can be tough, yeah.
As an independent producer, like, I don't often have that information unless I'm at KBU and, like, the newsroom gets information or something like that, so.
Yeah, it's good to be in touch with, you know, if you have a news director at your station or a daily newscast, it's good to be in touch with them, and it helps, and it actually helps to be on the ahead of the curve on things if you are doing local news as a volunteer every day, if you can swing it or as many days as possible, because of
I've tried more comments on this though. Like what I try to do, because I file a lot of headlines for FSRN. I know nobody really wants to do that, but it's fun for me. I like to do it. But one of the things that I do is just keep a mailing list of all the contacts I have in the community. So if the ACLU has a major, like the last story I did was yesterday with a WTO settlement came out in Seattle. People got paid for having their constitutional rights violated. And the ACLU sent me a press release. So I got the scoop because nobody else, you know, the print journalists, they were all sleeping or whatever, and nobody's doing it on television. So that's a good thing to do. The other thing is that when you're doing headlines, it is a very different thing from features.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to, like, these 3 days of emails, it's not going to happen. And especially on the East Coast, or East Coast, West Coast deadlines are really strange because you may be dealing with people that are coming in at WBAI or down in California, and you're covering a story and you're working on it all night, and then the editor comes in the morning, and it's like you can't even like deal with them anymore. So sometimes with headlines, they don't even call me. They don't even send me an email. Sometimes they will. Like I got a call from Brian Tinker Jones, whatever his name is, the other day, but sometimes they won't. Sometimes they'll just put your stuff on the air. So you have to be ready for that, you know. And also, they won't necessarily tell you. So if you don't go find out, you know, your piece may be, you know, a headline story, and then you've never even heard from the editor. So just a warning on that.
You can check the FSRN website, and they have a rundown every day, and you can listen to the cast, and then you know when to...
Send them a bill.
Send them the invoice.
And the cast changes from 1:00 to.
But I guess what I'm saying, if anybody's interested in doing headlines, which you know is really important, I think, because it's breaking stories, you have to be really good at editing yourself and having it pretty much all ready to go. Because a lot of times there's no time. If they have to edit with you, it's too late, because they're calling you at 9:30 in the morning saying, you know, we got to edit this part. You know, can you do that? And if you're not available for that phone call, they'll either drop the story, or they'll just run it as it is. So just, you know, it's just a different thing.
Yeah. There's a separate headlines producer also.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
when
yeah,
you pitch, you're pitching to the headlines person or you're pitching to the features people. So there's different people that are in charge of that. And the thing, too, is that you have to remember that they're a really busy, underfunded grassroots organization. So if you don't hear back from them and you think, well, you know, either they're going to run it, what's happening, call them, email them, you know, say, hey, I don't want to bug you, but did you get my story? Or, you know, are you going to run my story or whatever? Because they, I think that I've never heard back from them, like, hey, don't email us, you know, or whatever. They're just like, oh, yeah, sorry, we forgot, you know, and then they'll be happy to get on it. But they get so many emails every day, and they deal with so much stuff to produce an international newscast on a daily basis that...
And each producer is different because they cover for each other. So one person has one way of dealing with you and another person has another way. But the main thing about headlines is if it's more than 24 hours old, don't bother.
Yeah.
Well, then my question is, do you pitch headlines?
Yeah.
Or do you just... Or do you write them and just send them?
You pitch them, but you start working on it before they get back to you.
Yeah.
You have to be ready to jump immediately.
I mean, it's only a 60-second thing, so type it out.
I have a feeling that they work with different people in different ways.
They
do. If you're on the West Coast, you know, and it's a late breaking story that you're covering at midnight and they're coming in the morning, they may not... worry whether you pitched it. They're just worried that you have the audio and it's waiting for them.
And sometimes they'll just take it over the phone if they want it that bad. Meaning that you have it, they'll take it on the phone.
Yeah.
So you don't have to bother with the edit.
Do you have a question?
It's kind of both. My name's Allison from CHR Radio in Vancouver. I started doing video features every once in a while for FSRN. It's been so awesome because I've learned a lot. It's like, and the thing I've noticed that's most useful is to be really persistent about asking questions and also like they'll call me on a lot of stuff that I don't know right away. Like, if I get something wrong that's, like, technical, they'll walk me through. Like, I've been walked through stuff, so I've learned a lot. And I guess, like, I really appreciate that. And I feel so fantastic that I get to continue to do a lot of FSRN. I guess my question is, I do a lot of things from my campaign perspective, and I want to know, just generally, like, what kind of stuff is useful to pitch to FSRN in terms of features that are coming outside of the United States?
I'd say the big Canadian political issues that you know, people around the world, I mean, it's almost a global newscast, would
yeah.
be interested in. Definitely the big environmental things that happen in BC.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two that come to mind immediately.
Did you get a copy of the pitching guidelines? Kind of
they're on the website.
Yeah, they're on the website. So if people
try to sound as forward as you can. They're more likely to take it.
I've noticed that.
International
interest.
Anyone can understand. Accentuate
your Canadian accent.
Yes, that's right.
Never say about, say a boot.
Use the process.
Okay. And a lot of times I think the... I get pretty good email response if my story's on the rundown. It's going to be on that day, you know, because I'll the deadline, I think, is 10 a.m., right?
For 10 a.m. for headlines and 11 for features.
11 for features to get your audio in. They've let me get it in late on occasion because they know I'm persistent and I'm gonna get them that audio.
That's
and
East Coast time, right?
No, this
West
is Pacific Coast. And they will... they do appreciate it when you have the piece completed, completely edited, but usually for a new reporter, they don't want you to mix audio in, say, ambient sound. They want the units of sound, sort of like on the screen here. I don't have any ambient audio, but they want the individual files so they can piece it together themselves because they have their standards of how they want it mixed. They let me mix it, but I guess I've been doing it for years, so you know, they trust what I'm going to do. But yeah,
I'm just curious. I mean, since you have a relationship with them, if you're kind of getting to this point where you feel like you can mix stuff together, if you sent them the pieces and a mix, is that?
Yeah, they might just accept your mix if you have time to do it. A lot of stories don't involve mixing. They involve soundbite, your voice, your voice, soundbite, your voice, soundbite. And so all it is a pasting together sort of thing. And that's okay. They seem to want at least 0.2 seconds between action of silence or the end of the ambient noise of your actuality before your voice comes in again. They've gotten on my case for being too quick because I used 0.1 seconds. And you can see at the top of the screen there, there's the number of seconds, and it's divided in 0.1 seconds. It is sort of a quality control that, you know, they may adjust your levels. And one thing I'll show you, I guess, just with this sound file, what I do sometimes and it may not be necessary, or they might do it themselves. This is SoundForge, which is an editing program, which is really good. It tends to be what they use in when they produce the newscast. But it's expensive. It costs money. And there's also free ones that do almost the same things. But what I'll do, under effects here, there's Let's see, there's graphic dynamics, and then under DX favorites, there's another dynamic. So are you familiar with the concept of dynamic compression in audio? It's not the same as compressing something into an MP3 to save space on your computer. It's the process of taking the quieter points and making them louder. This is still the guy talking. And the reason that might be of an advantage to you, it's a comprehension thing. A lot of people do not listen to their radios in the quiet of their living room. They listen in cars with surface noise from the tires hitting the road, the babies crying, the dogs barking, or sometimes they listen to a weak signal because their community stations tend to be low power and they have a unique format. And, you know, rather than listening to Top 40, they might listen 10 miles out through the static or whatever. So by compressing the dynamics a little bit, and this has already been compressed some, and I'll give it, like, just make it obvious, 5.5. I usually use 3.4. Hit OK, and watch what happens to the sound. See, it squished down a little bit. And now, when you normalize, this is the key for normalizing. It's also in the drop-down box under process. When you normalize, that takes the loudest sound and brings it up. And now, some of the quieter syllables are actually louder in comparison to everything else, and so there's more sound energy in that sound bite, therefore it might be more comprehensible. You know, listening in the studio, you'll understand everything, but some listening environments differ, so especially over the air. So I just wanted to mention that, and they will do some of that for you, but you can help them out by doing that.
And I would say, too, that if you're mixing from, like, say you go to an event and you've got a lot of, like, ambient sound of, like, people walking around or a protest or something, and you've got actualities from that, and then your narration that you're doing in a studio, it's really good to mix some of that ambient sound underneath your voice so it's not so, you know, it's hard for people, like, if they're listening in a car or the baby's crying or dog barking, to kind of go back and forth. They're like, wait, what happened? It's almost like the story ended because that sound changes so much. So what I like to do is just have my microphone out, record a bunch of ambient sound, and then you can just fade it under your voice so that it's probably barely noticeable to the listener, but it provides a lot of continuity for your story.
Do you think that it's best to, when you do translation, to do your own mixing or just send them the translation and the actual file?
They want the actual file of the foreign language person. And they sometimes will do it for you if you don't have an extra person. Because I used to produce at my house, and there's no way around to be the other voice. So they'll supply another voice, and they will mix. And it's better to let them mix because basically when the voice underneath is, it's got to be very low to avoid interfering with your ability to hear what the English translator is saying.
But if it's what my experience is, if it's too low, then people forget that this is a translator and they think that that's the Prime Minister from South Korea speaking.
Well, you got to let them use their production standards on that. And what they will tend to do is play 2 to 5 seconds of the person talking in a foreign language. Sometimes it depends on the language because people understand Spanish, they might go for 10 seconds and then they'll do a little fade and it'll be underneath and then the translator voice will come on.
And then usually after the translator, they'll bring the other voice back.
They might. They might do that.
Yeah. Because I think the problem is people forget that this is translated, and they start listening only to the translator's voice, thinking that's the person that you're interviewing.
Right. Sure enough. Sure enough.
Are there other questions?
Yeah. I have one about shelf life. I tend to write for as long shelf life as I can, maybe as much as 6 months. Some of the stories that you need immediate events. How does that fit in with FSL? They're doing mostly really immediate kinds of things?
Mostly. As you get into the issues that come up in, say, a place like Idaho or Montana, I think there's a little longer shelf life than there is for the immediate coastal political stories, I guess. But you have to pay attention to the political arc of the story. If there's a vote coming up in the Senate on forest issues or something like that, you want to get it done and in to actually give the listener enough time to maybe contact their congressional representative about this issue, you know. So you don't even want it on like a day before sometimes. They may disagree, but, you know, it is tricky. It's good to you also may miss a chance. Maybe somebody else will pitch that story and get ahead of you. And I wanted to go back to choosing a story. One thing is to keep.
That's the basis of my question.
Read the rundown. If you can't listen to the newscast every day, read the rundown on the website and know which stories have been covered, which stories they've done. I've been very successful at pitching with them because I know when I pitch a story that they have not covered this yet. So if you know what FSRN is covering and if you have a good idea, you know, you're in tune with what they're covering, then you can be more successful at pitching.
Yeah, a couple of questions. What does it pay, and do you all make a living doing it solely, and do you have press credentials? Do you use press credentials?
Okay, I'd say it pays
scales,
poorly.
Yes, it does pay poorly. The pay scale's on the pitching guidelines.
$160 for a feature, generally.
Okay.
3.5 to 4 minutes. The headlines are $20 or $30, depending on when you have, if you have interview audio. I don't know. There may be a few people in third world countries that make their living selling FSRN stories. Sam Alakoya from Nigeria comes to mind. And where, you know, the price of living is cheaper. But generally not. I get paid a small amount to manage a low power FM station, and that's where most of my income comes from. This is just extra.
And I'm a freelance, well, I do a lot of freelance journalism, and I always have a part-time job also, so a lot of times if I can sell a story to FSRN and also sell it in a print format as well, like, I mean, I end up rewriting the whole thing, but if it's, you can use the same actualities, I mean, obviously you have to ask people's permission and stuff, but that can be a way to kind of make more money with it, but it's not sustainable as a sole, you know, as the only thing you're doing.
Press credentials, the other question was press credentials, and they do come in handy, and especially in the post-9/11 world, they're more and more careful about letting people into certain events with big people, you know, or a presidential or head of state might be there. I got press credentials for the WTO in Seattle in 99 when I was working for Pacifica Network News, which was the predecessor before the strike to FSRN, and that allowed me not to get pepper sprayed and all past cops and stuff. I also have my G8 Calgary press thing, and so when I go to events that might have a lot of big people there, like the, you know, the conference, National Conference of Governors or Western Governors Association, where they insist on press credentials, usually whip out your old things from the big things you've been to, the G8 or the WTO, and they say, oh, okay. Some of the WTO, I had to like fax things to Switzerland or something to get that. Yeah.
If you can have a press pass from your local community radio station too, if you've ever done local stories for them, that's what I use. I just have a KBOO press pass and it's got my picture and the signature of the news director, and that seems to be enough for most people.
Yeah, and unless they stop you, just walk in like you know what you're doing. You know. You know. You have a reporter, you have a right to report on public policy.
Well, and not being known as a reporter can really work to your advantage, too, because people will be like, well, you know, who is this person? It's this local community station. They're not as careful with what they say a lot of times. So it can work to your advantage more than, I think, to your disadvantage.
Question here on press releases.
Well, that may clue you in on a story.
No, press release, getting a release from the person who you said you broadcast.
No, they assume that you're covering your bases. I mean, they don't have the time.
If you have a microphone, people, you know, will ask you, what are you recording for, or whatever, and you just tell them, you know. I end up telling people what Free Speech Radio News is all the time, because they're like, what, huh, what organization is that?
And daily, nationwide.
Yeah,
news.
You tell them it's nationally syndicated,
yeah.
They kind of go, oh.
So around here, if I say I'm doing a report for FSRN, everybody wants to talk to you immediately. Because I'm usually interviewing activists and organizers, and they're like,
yes, that's the other side.
You
of
you get the interview, the Fox guys, forget it, you.
Yeah, people scratch their heads when you say that.
Yeah. go ahead.
I'm more likely to get an interview in Vancouver from a Canadian or from someone who thinks I'm a good chauffeur. Like, I used to check for my station CITR or FSRN, often the same things with different tweaks because of different audiences. They'll talk to me more if they know it's going to America. It's different.
That is interesting.
I have a question about FSRN's growth potential of plans. Are they going to be, is it going to be a program maybe about 28 minutes, which is kind of what you're doing now? Will there be a duplicate of that? And
right now we're in negotiations with Pacifica, which we usually are. we haven't had a reporter raise forever and ever. But yet we've always had, the bulk of our funding has continued to come from Pacifica. Right now we're getting about $570,000. That's what we put that newscast on with a year. And we really need $800,000 to make it kick and to raise rates. But we're in negotiations with them. We want our autonomy, and Pacifica is kind of a, you're not so sure that you really want to, join forces with Pacifica. But
sort of the hierarchical
content is very useful and worthwhile, and so.
Yeah.
Are you locking yourself into a specific box in a sense? Or are there other funding organizations?
The next negotiations call that those of us who are on the FSRN negotiating team have, I'm going to keep pushing that we really let our listeners know how desperately we need a fundraiser so that we can basically ignore Pacifica. That to me would be the best of all possible worlds. But we've never been that successful in getting fundraising. And having a really skilled fundraiser in our court. But, yeah.
What was the situation before FSRN Pacifica Network News?
With Pacifica Network News, well, were you here right at the beginning?
Yes.
Flames, right?
Yeah.
So what, I'm not sure.
Well, not more than a sentence or two.
Oh, okay. Well, Pacifica Network News, as far as pay, was pretty low, too. I think it was about the same range we're getting now, and so we haven't had an increase even since the Pacifica Network News did.
No, but what I mean is Pacifica Network News was obviously not independent of Pacifica.
Right.
Right.
And FSRN seems to be, but not really. So
exactly.
All right.
Yeah.
It is.
The editorial.
Editorially.
Yes.
Yes,
okay.
Can you guys talk about the foundation? I mean, did you mention that?
We did talk about that. Mm-hmm.
We did. Which side of the equation on the foundation?
Just the fact that, when I get paid, it's from Free Speech Radio, or Pacifica Reporters for Free Speech.
Pacifica Reporters Against
Censorship.
That's the overarching nonprofit.
Yes. So how does that work? Is that just a foundation from all sorts of different sources, not just Pacifica, right?
No, that's just Pacifica. We're not able to survive on $550,000 a year, so we do fundraise. So we're always pitching on our own, but not strongly enough to be truly independent. Yeah.
Right.
They're just
financial.
Our fiscal, to be financial.
But Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship technically is a nonprofit.
501(c)(3). Yeah,
yeah.
We've got our own status.
Yeah, and it's independent of Pacifica technically.
I find that really interesting. I think it's cool watching.
Question in the
back. Put in a pitch. Benny Lombardo over there. I'm Adrian Wabi. We're both part of the elected steering committee of FSRN. It is in our bylaws, it's a reporter-run organization. The steering committee has to be, by bylaws, so many reporters. So if you start to pitch anywhere, one deadline, you can consider yourself a member and start thinking about how you can, work with the organization to strengthen it and manage it, because we don't have an outside management thing. It's the reporters and the staff that's supposed to run this thing.
And that's pretty unique on this planet.
Would you recommend starting with that, if you're for breaking in and just sort of getting your feet wet, starting with headlines first before you make them to the features?
Yes.
Not necessarily.
I mean, it depends on your approach. I mean, if you have not done a lot of news stories at all before, I would say that it is a good approach to start with a headline because, that'll get your feet wet in terms of reporting in general. And, then you can, sort of learn the process and how that works and stuff and how to write pitches and how to get good quotes and stuff like that. But if you're a seasoned reporter with your community station, you could start with features.
Yeah. I recommend starting with features just because The pay's a little better. You have a little more time because they aren't, you know, the headlines is more breaking news that day, and some of the stories are what are called in the business evergreens. They may not be green forever, but you know they have a longer shelf life. So therefore, if you have a little trouble putting it together, you know it can be delayed for airing another couple of days while you get it together. And it also gives you a chance to tell a larger story, which I think the urge is there is that urge. I should say that in producing for radio, I've always found it takes a lot more time to produce something short than long. I guess when it comes to headlines, maybe that doesn't always follow, but you know, you're producing audio spots for your station with an edit every second. Mm-hmm. You know, it's different than a 1-hour interview with no breaks in it, you know. So it gives you a little more time to tell a longer, more in-depth story. That's your first story.
Well, yeah. Now that they have the mini features that are like, it's like a 2-minute feature, basically, might be a good way to start, too, if you wanted to do, like, have a little bit more time and not be under the pressure of producing something within 24 hours, then that might be a good way to go.
But it's really a craft. It's really a craft to be able to tell layered, complicated stories in a page and a third of copy. Because I'm always fighting with the 4 minutes, the 4 minutes 15, 4 minutes 30. So it really depends on just how you even operate as a writer. But remember, you literally only have, plus your lead, barely a page and a third of copy to tell a story. And when you write for print, you know, no, you've got 3 pages at least to tell.
One guideline is that I sort of use right from pitching the story. You basically, on a feature, have time to get 3 ideas across. I mean, there'll be some details, there'll be a voice telling, having an opinion, and this opinion, that. But basically, the story will get 3 ideas across, and you might as well pitch it that way. I think they understand that. Your pitch basically says the 3 ideas you intend to get across and a list of people you may try to interview.
Well, and while you really want to sell the story with your pitch, you want to be honest with them about, you know, I'm not sure if I can get this interview, or I'm pretty sure I can get this interview. You don't want to say, I'm going to be interviewing the mayor, and then, you know, he doesn't call you back, because then you're screwed.
I have 6 minutes for the next.
Oh, we got to go.
Okay, so we're done.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And we'll be around if you want to talk to us more about it.